All his veteran's coolness under fire, his heart was pounding hard enough they'd could feel it in his chest. Dallas jerked hard to port, and the opening shifted away, coming back half into his field of view a second later, as the AI reacted to the battleship's evasive maneuver. He moved his arm again, slightly, a minor adjustment, and his ship zipped through the opening and came down on the landing pad. He was a little off to the side as opposed to his usual right on target, but it was close enough. He reached down, pulling the release that opened his cockpit as he unhooked his harnesses. Then he jumped up, climbing out onto the fighter's stubby wing before the flight crew had even gotten the portable ladder in place. He scrambled down as soon as they set it against his ship, and as he climbed down, his eyes darted all around until they settled on who he was looking for. "Chief!" he yelled, jumping down the last few rungs of the ladder and jogging across the deck toward the large, perennially grouching man who ruled Dauntless's flight decks like a dictator. Evans had a reputation for scaring even officers who outranked him, but Stockton was like a man possessed. He knew to what extent the battle rested on him, and on his squadrons, but he wasn't about to take shit from anyone, not even the legendary Chief Evans. "I want these fighters coming in refit and ready to go, and Chief, I mean instantly. Do you understand me?" Evans was technically in Star's chain of command and not Stockton's. Pilots on the flight deck were mostly expected to stand around and wait for their birds to be cleared for takeoff. But Stockton didn't have time for that shit. Not now. Evans stood still for an instant, even as several members of Dauntless's flight crew gathered around, cowering a bit before the crackling rage of their terrifying boss. They'd seen Evans explode at far less, and even Stockton's high rank seemed unlikely to quiet the storm that was coming. But Evans just nodded and said, "Yes, sir." And with that, the legend of Jake Raptor Stockton grew yet again. "The cure was a success, sir. I've treated the last of the infected parties, and the virus should be completely eradicated in even the sickest of them within 2 to 3 days. Dauntless shook from another hit as Doc Weldon's voice came over the comm. Almost immediately, the control center lights flickered as the flagship's quad primary battery returned the fire. The new Dauntless packed not only double the number of main guns her predecessors had carried, but the whole system was a damned sight more durable, too, with multiple backups for the energy transmission system. "That's wonderful news, Stu. I can't tell you what a fantastic job you've done or how grateful I am." Baron had been focused entirely on the battle when Weldon's comm had come in. He'd almost refused the call until the battle was over. Now his attention was almost entirely on his gifted chief surgeon and on the incredible news he just delivered. "Thank you, sir." Weldon's voice was somber, hesitant. "Cheer up, Doc. You licked it. You should be proud." Baron was concerned about the battle, very concerned. But Weldon sounded somehow down, and it was almost automatic for him to support his people, especially when they'd accomplished the near impossible. Baron didn't know what was bothering Weldon. Perhaps the people who died before he completed the serum? "Yes, sir, but Atara..." Baron felt his blood run cold. The last he'd heard, Atara hadn't even shown any signs of the disease. Had she become sick, not responded to the serum? He could feel his stomach tightening, even more than it had been already. "What is it?" "She has an immunity, and I used blood samples from her to develop the serum, but we needed more, Admiral, much more." Weldon paused, and his discomfort was palpable even over the comm. "She insisted. She ordered me." "What happened?" Baron's tone was harsher now, demanding. "Saving everyone required so much blood. I put her into one of the med pods, but, well, it was too much for her, Admiral." Baron felt as though he was going to vomit. "No, not Atara." "What do you mean, too much?" "She's in a coma, Admiral. I've tried all I can think of, every treatment, but she hasn't responded to anything." A pause. When he continued, his tone was grim. "I don't know what else I can do, sir." He hesitated again, and Baron knew what the doctor's next words would be. "She's dying, Admiral." Chapter 42. Troyus City. Planet Megara, Oleus 3. Year 315 AC. "Here's the information I promised, Senator. I think you will find it very interesting." Desiree Marielis extended her hand, dropping the small data crystal into Farrell's pudgy palm. She looked up at the Confederation politician and smiled. "I can think of no one better suited to see that these crimes are punished." Actually, pretty much everything on the crystal was a fabrication. Holston's extended absence from Megara had allowed her data people to plant all sorts of things into the mogul's financial records. Evidence of bribes, personal perversions, and illegally feeding war business to the Holston interests. She designed it all herself, creating the perfect image of a man who was a vile criminal in his public and business affairs, and a hideous monster in private. She had more to back it all up, a list of sympathetic past victims of Holston's manipulations and abuses. They were all phonies, of course, but Mariellis had learned long before that actual truth was of marginal value at best. She had no doubt Holston could discredit the accusations. His wealth and power gave him the resources and access to the media he would need. But seeing the head of Confederation Intelligence convicted of crimes wasn't her goal. She needed to create chaos, and discrediting Holston for long enough to prevent him from interfering with her plans, that was well worth the effort.
I thank you again for your patriotism, Desiree. If more of our citizens were as devoted and conscientious as you, the Confederation would surely prosper.
Farrell moved slightly, bringing himself a bit closer. Mariellis felt the urge to recoil, but her discipline kicked in. Men like Holston threaten the freedoms we all hold dear, Senator. It is the duty of every citizen to fight such corruption. What an imbecile. Her cover was strong, but she'd planted triggers to warn her if anyone was poking around too much in her manufactured background. So far, there hadn't been the slightest indication the Senator, or any of the others she was dealing with, had made even a token effort to check her out. The fools deserve what's coming to them. I'm just gratified I was able to find a public servant who is a true patriot himself. She paused. In my business, I'm afraid I see the underside of things far too often. It tends to make one cynical.
I understand that, Desiree, but in this case, you can be assured justice will prevail. The ship carrying Mr. Holston is approaching Megara as we speak. He will soon be in the Senate's custody, and he will be compelled to answer not only for his crimes on Danith, but also for those you have brought to light.
Mariella smiled, her warmth and apparent sincerity a testament to her immense skill at tradecraft. Yes, Senator, you will do just that. Mariellis didn't trust Farrell. She didn't trust anybody, but the small part of her smile that was genuine was powered by the fact that she had a second data crystal, one she'd placed in a very secure location. Its contents were much like those in her Holston file, with two important differences. The crimes and perversions listed on the second crystal were all true, and they all detailed the clandestine activities of one Senator Emerson Tolbert Farrell. Mariellis knew very well that Gary Holston had his own files on Farrell, and she didn't have the slightest doubt that Farrell would fold almost instantly when Holston threatened to destroy him. When Farrell inevitably came to her with excuses for dropping the case against Holston, she would assure him that if he stopped the investigation, she would crush him as completely as Holston would. That would be a shocking moment for the arrogant but fundamentally gutless senator. It was one she looked forward to with great anticipation. She imagined the instant when Farrell realized he faced personal ruin no matter what he did. That should give the pompous ass something to think about, other than staring at my ass.
Desiree, are you free this evening? I can arrange a quiet dinner at my villa. We can review this material together and perhaps...
I'm so sorry, Senator. You know I'd love to have dinner with you, but I'm afraid I have another appointment. Work, sadly. It never seems to stop.
She paused, forcing herself to smile coyly at the Senator.
This is pure work, I'm afraid. Not like what we share.
Soon then, Desiree.
I will count the moments.
She maintained the grin, surprising herself with just how much energy it took. Then she said,
Please, review what I've just given you. Gary Holston has run rampant for far too long. It's a disgrace.
One we will end, my dear Desiree, thanks to your help.
You're too kind, Senator. I'll see you soon. She nodded gently, and then she turned and walked away, hoping he didn't notice her pace quickening as she got away from him.
I am told we have at last gained a controlling interest in the stock. A very well-executed effort, Gustav. The annual meeting is in 4 days, and at that time, you will announce your holdings and elect a new board of directors, one entirely controlled by us.
Mariellis looked across the room at Gustav Shepard. That wasn't his real name, of course, any more than his position as a maverick investment manager representing off-world interests was genuine. But he looked the part of an upper-class Megaran despite the fact that he'd come from the streets of one of the Union's most backward and impoverished fringe worlds.
Shepard had been on Megara far longer than Marialis, through the entire war, in fact. His assignment, then, had been to spy on Confederation industrial interests and get as much data back to Mont Morale as possible. His cover was very deep, so much so that Marialis had wondered if the agent might have become too attached to the privileged position his cover afforded him. From all she'd been able to discern from the files, he'd even exhibited somewhat of an actual talent for investing, and he'd taken on a fairly long list of real investors to supplement the initial funds that had come from Sector 9 and its various controlled entities. But Shepard had done everything she told him to do since she'd arrived, and he'd even passed the two traps she'd laid to catch him if he was betraying her. "Thank you. It was a significant project, but we were finally able to track down a few last blocks of stock. We now control 50.32% of the company." Mariella smiled, an expression far more genuine than those she'd managed for Farrell's consumption. The company she now controlled, through Shepard and an impenetrable array of dummy entities, was the second largest media network on Megara. Its tentacles extended throughout the Confederation. It was a corrupt enterprise, as all such were, but its prejudices and biases had always been variable, driven more by the beliefs and vanities of its managerial ranks than by any rational agenda. Now its dishonesty would be diverted to a single purpose, to spread exactly the news she wanted Megarans to see. Control of the network gave her direct access to over 30% of the capital's population, and billions more throughout the Confederation. "I can't express sincerely enough my admiration and gratitude for all you have achieved here, Gustav. I can assure you I will let Father know how well you have done." The name Gaston Villeneuve wasn't commonly known in the Confederation, but Marialis was cautious by nature. Too many people in the circles she frequented for the operation knew exactly who Villeneuve was. "I'm very appreciative. You've directed the mission with great skill. I trust we will soon be able to move forward from these preparatory operations and at last launch Black Dawn."
"Soon, Gustav. Hopefully."
Marialis had to admit to herself, she'd enjoyed far greater success than she'd imagined possible. But she wasn't one to get carried away. Black Dawn was still a long way from completion. Perhaps not quite as long as it had been, but far from a guaranteed success.
"Meanwhile, you know how to proceed."
She stood still, quiet for a moment.
"I have to go. I have another meeting, a very critical one."
She now had assets in the media, industry, law enforcement, and the Senate. But she needed the military. That had been the toughest one. The Confederation Armed Forces were full of career officers and spacers, and she'd found far less corruption in their ranks than she'd expected. But now she believed she'd found just what she was looking for— an officer, pliable enough to play the role she'd prepared. Admiral Torrence Whitten wore 3 stars on his uniform, but he'd never commanded a force larger than a pack of convoy escorts. He owed his rank and the absurd cluster of unearned decorations he wore on his chest to his senator father's wealth and power. Marialis's eyes had widened when she'd first read his profile. Whitten was almost perfect for her plans, a high-ranking officer from a highly placed family. Bitter because he felt he'd been unfairly overlooked for promotions and real command positions. She suspected there were reasons for that, and almost certainly Whitten was somewhat less than tactically gifted. Hell, she'd realized that just from reading the file. Resentful, pompous, full of himself. She couldn't imagine a better asset if she'd created one from thin air. She was confident she could swing him, but she knew her game had to be perfect. "Let him complain," she reminded herself. "Let him tell you how unfair it has all been, how his rivals have derailed his career. Don't even bring up that subject until he does." She glanced down at the tablet in her hand, rereading the small summary and looking at the photo. Whitten might be a narcissistic idiot who'd managed to sideline a career that had been handed to him on a silver platter, but he was easy enough on the eyes. Tall, trim, dark hair and eyes. Just what she liked. Unlike the disgusting Farrell, she would handle this one very personally. She would bribe him, console him, gradually offer him the chance at revenge against those who had injured him, and a way to get him the rank and power he so rightfully deserved. Seduction was very much on the table with this one. Chapter 43 CFS Dauntless Z-11 System Year 315 AC Baron stared at the display, determinedly pushing his thoughts back to the battle, away from his friend down on the surface, barely clinging to life.
Dying. Doc said she's dying. The thought of her lying silent in a med pod, her body simply giving out, seemed wrong to him. She was a warrior like he was. If she had to die, it should be in action, where he could be at her side. But she'd saved almost 200 of her comrades, her sacrifice giving them all a chance to escape the deadly disease. As soon as Doc Weldon cleared the last of the landing party, Baron could bring them all back up to the fleet and get the hell out of this system, and go home to warn the entire Rim that the fleet had found a deadly new enemy. Assuming we survive this battle. That was far from a sure thing. The fleet was barely holding its own. He owed that mostly to Jake Stockton and his squadrons. Anya Fritz's mines and Stockton's fighter strikes had caused enough damage to equalize the fight between Baron's battleships and the technologically superior hegemony vessels. Even now his people worked feverishly to deliver death and destruction to the enemy. Sweating gunners labored at their panels, supervising and adjusting the targeting of the AIs, trying to recognize patterns in the enemy moves. Dauntless's teams were used to being the best, pounding their enemies relentlessly with hit after hit. But the maneuverability of the hegemony vessels defied their skills and reduced their hit ratio to one more befitting a group of rookie trainees instead of the deadliest veterans in space. Or at least the deadliest on the Rim. Baron leaned back in his chair, staring at the display. He'd been a flag officer for several years now, but he still had to remind himself at times that he was responsible for an entire fleet, and not just a single vessel. That was harder now since he'd filled in for Atara and taken direct command of the battleship. But the fleet didn't need anything from him. Not now. Not really. There were no elaborate tactics, no ruses of war that would make a difference. The enemy ships were faster, more maneuverable, and the fleets were already nose-to-nose, blasting away at each other. The battle was in the crew's hands now, and every one of them giving his or her best. Of that much, Baron was certain. It was frustrating, but there was still nothing for him to do but watch. Dauntless shook again, another of the enemy beams connecting. The flagship had been spared a hit from the deadly railguns, but Baron knew it could happen at any time. Dauntless had taken considerable damage, but her primaries had held out during the entire approach. Now at point-blank range, he'd switched over to the more numerous and quicker-firing secondaries. Dauntless was locked in a duel with one of the big enemy vessels, and the ships were moving toward each other, cutting the already short range to knife-fighting distance. It was a death struggle, a duel only one ship could survive, and Baron flashed back to the battle years before with Katrine Regellis and Invictus. The old Dauntless had won that desperate fight, though only by the slimmest of margins. For all the skill and dedication of his people, Baron had never deceived himself that the slim difference in that fight had been bravery or training. In that, the two sides were evenly matched, nor had his tactical capability exceeded that of his brilliant rival. Katrine Regellis had been a brilliant tactician. No. Fortune had favored him that day and condemned his noble enemy. And the luck that had saved him then had been with him on many occasions since. He wondered if he could count on such favor again, or if he'd used up his generous allotment, if he'd come so far from home only to meet defeat and death. Admiral, Captain Stockton reports he's launching Blue and Scarlet Eagle squadrons, both fitted out for bombing missions. Sonya Eaton's voice pulled him from his recollections. Very well, give Captain Stockton my best wish. He paused. No, put me on the channel with the launching squadrons. Yes, sir. A few seconds later. On your line, Admiral. Blues and Eagles, this is Admiral Baron. I know most of you are used to launching as interceptors, but right now, we need you to bomb the hell out of those enemy battleships. You're the best pilots on Dauntless, the best in the whole damned fleet, but you know that already. What some of you may not know are the names of the aces that have preceded you and who are no longer here. Your squadrons have fought for Dauntless in a seemingly endless series of desperate fights, and those fallen heroes are all here with you today. He was speaking, of course, mostly at least, of pilots who had been killed in action, though his mind drifted to the Eagle's former commander, Dirk Warrior Timmons. Timmons had been the only pilot Baron had ever met who rivaled Stockton in daring and skill. But Timmons had lost both his legs in a terrible crash in the old Dauntless's landing bay. He'd mastered his prosthesis, and Baron had no doubt the pilot could fly, perhaps as well as ever. But regulations had cost him his active wings, and Timmons was back at the academy now, teaching new pilots.
Baron suddenly wished Warrior was where he belonged, in the cockpit of a fighter, alongside his one-time rival and now friend, Raptor.
And you're out there today with Raptor, the best pilot who has ever lived, so go out there and show the enemy what Confederation aces can do.
Baron reached down and cut the line, and a few seconds later he felt the familiar vibrations as Dauntless's launch catapults sent her elite squadrons back into the fray.
It's the energy transmission lines, Commodore. We've lost power to all the guns on the port broadside.
Damn. Sarah Eaton slammed her fist against her thigh. She was usually a block of ice on the bridge, hiding her emotions, certainly ones like frustration and fear, at least, from her crew. But she knew just how close the battle was. The fleet needed every ship on the line, and Repulse was one of its heaviest ships.
Fire up the positioning jets, bring the starboard guns around to bear, and revise our evasion plan to account for the new aspect.
Yes, Commodore. The nav officer had paused for an instant before responding, and Eaton knew why. The change in bearing would require a reprogramming of the evasive maneuvers, and there was no way that could be implemented without reducing effectiveness, at least for a short time. At the range Repulse had closed to, even one extra hit from those enemy beams, and God forbid one of the railguns, could make the difference between her ship surviving the fight or not.
Assuming any of us survive.
Executing, Commodore. Before she could respond, Eaton felt a series of slight vibrations, one after the other, fighters launching.
Very well, Commander, she replied, a few seconds later than normal. She thought about her squadrons. The enhanced evasive maneuvers were playing havoc with fighter operations, and she suspected the bearing change she'd just ordered, and which flight control knew nothing about, would make things worse. Still, her launch bay crews were getting at least some ships out, even if the wild gyrations and Repulse's thrust meant they were scattered all over the place. She imagined the disorganization, which was hardly limited to Repulse's fighters, was gutting the effectiveness of the bombing runs. But then she glanced up at the display and saw clusters of bombers moving in, at least a dozen of them against the enemy ship closest to Repulse. They were from different squadrons, intermixed and coming in from all angles. And yet somehow they were making it work. She knew exactly how. Jake Stockton. She'd been surprised when Baron had promoted his strike force leader and put him in overall command of the entire fleet's fighters. Eaton had been a ship commander before she'd become a Commodore, and she understood that any captain would be disgruntled, at least, to lose a portion of command authority over his or her vessel. For the battleships, that damn sure included the fighter wings. But Stockton was proving the wisdom of Baron's move, as he had been since the first enemy ships had arrived. His wings had recognized their advantage immediately, and they'd been pounding at home ever since. Eaton knew the fleet would have been obliterated already if it hadn't been for the initial bombing runs, and now Stockton was turning the chaos into a coordinated assault, one that was keeping the fleet in the fight. She saw that Repulse had completed its reorientation, and before the nav officer could report to that effect, she turned toward the tactical station and said, "Starboard batteries, open fire."
All right, Tactical Force Omega, we're going in now and we're going to go right down that thing's throat.
Jake Stockton took a deep breath and tightened his grip around his ship's controls. He was used to flying an interceptor and he found the bloated and clumsy bombing kit to be a major drag on maneuverability. He sympathized with bomber pilots in a way he wasn't sure he had before, especially when they had to go up against more maneuverable interceptors.
At least that's not a concern here. Mustang 6 and 8, you're drifting out of position. Tighten up and get in line. Red 6, kick up your thrust a notch. You're lagging.
He had a force of 19 bombers, one that was made up of parts of 5 different squadrons from 3 different battleships. It was, in technical military terms, a complete mess. But it was what he had, and if he had to tell every one of them where to fly and how, then that was what he would do. Whatever it took, that big bastard of a ship up ahead was going to get a good pounding. Stockton had scanned the entire hegemony fleet, and he'd come to one conclusion that was really not much more than a guess. The ship in front of his small force of bombers was the enemy flagship, and it was also one of the hegemony ships that had suffered the least damage so far. He had almost 200 fighters back in space now, all that the battered ships of the fleet had been able to refit and launch. He figured a few more might trickle out, but most of those still absent were trapped in damaged bays or stuck aboard crippled ships, unable to rearm and refuel them. He'd done the best he could to organize the disordered attacks, and then he'd picked out the largest battleship as the premier target in the enemy's line. He was also personally leading the assault.
Form up on me, and whatever happens, go off my lead. He pulled back on the throttle, feeling the thrust slam him back into his seat. His fighters were close to the target already, well within plasma torpedo range. But Stockton and his people were going to take their weapons in a damned sight closer before launching. He could see the big ship on his scanner, the size of the icon increasing as the range dropped below 20,000 and continued down. His velocity was over 500 kilometers per second, and he was still accelerating. He began mixing up his straight-line thrust with evasive maneuvers, and he tapped the comm again as he saw the enemy battleship open up with its light guns.
Remember, they may not have dedicated point defense arrays, but they've got weapons, and one hell of an AI targeting suite. Keep moving, remember your evasive patterns. Anybody who gets blown away on this run is going to be in deep trouble with me, so watch yourselves.
He angled his vector a few degrees, and then back again, bouncing around without seriously altering his course toward the target ship. He could see his pilots emulating his actions, weaving all over the display. But one of them was hit nevertheless, and the symbol disappeared from his scanner as he was watching. The range was under 10,000 now, and the fire was thicker, heavier. He saw a pulse go by, perhaps 500 meters from his fighter. That was far enough to be well out of the danger zone, but close enough in terms of space battle to add to the sweat soaking the inside of his flight suit.
Pay attention, all of you. We're in the kill zone here, and that works both ways. Stay focused, and let's get this done.
6,000 kilometers. He glanced quickly to the long-range scanner, a quick check on his other groups and on the battle as a whole. The two lines were locked in a deadly slugging match, and all along the front, small forces of bombers were slipping in, trying to make a difference with their runs. The numbers on his screen continued to drop, slipping under 5,000. It was beyond point-blank range, closer than he'd ever led an attack in. But he still held his fire. He was going to go closer. Close enough to slam his torpedo right into that thing's hull without giving the bastards a chance to even think about evading. He angled his thrust again, his ship bouncing around so wildly it challenged even his cast-iron veteran's stomach. Still, he drove forward, increasing his velocity. He was on a course directly for the hulking ship, and at less than 4,000 meters he had about 7 seconds before his bombing run became a suicide attack. He held steady, his hand gripping the throttle so tightly his fingers were white. He could feel the sweat on his palms, and he gripped even harder, struggling to keep his hand from sliding around. His torpedo was ready, armed, and just as the range counted down to 2,500, he squeezed the firing stud. He'd pre-programmed the torpedo to fire up the reaction and convert to energy the instant it cleared his fighter, so now he had nothing to worry about except pulling his bird up and clearing the enemy ship. He hit full power, blasting hard to change his vector to a clear heading. He had to drop the evasive maneuvers for a few seconds, and he could almost feel the enemy batteries targeting his suddenly predictable ship. But nothing happened. His fighters zipped right by the massive hegemony vessel, and he watched as the torpedo slammed into its target dead on amidships. He let out a loud howl, grateful that his comm was off. For all his wildness, he'd come to understand, and mostly to embrace, his new command role. His people needed more out of him than a reckless role model teaching them to laugh at death. They needed a leader, and he'd promised himself that was just what they would get. He looked at the screen and smiled as his bombers, one by one, followed his course and holding their torpedoes to the last second, and then sending them right into the enemy vessel. At such a close range, the hegemony ship only managed to evade a few. His attack force lost two more ships, though it looked like one of the pilots at least had managed to eject, and when it was all over, they had scored no less than 10 hits. Stockton punched at the keys on his control panel, pulling up the damage assessments. The reports were a combination of scanning data and educated guesses by his ship's AI. But he didn't need any of that now. The energy readings suddenly spiked right off the scale, and the giant ship vanished in an explosion so furious, for a few seconds, it seemed like the system had acquired a second star.
All ships, full thrust directly ahead, now!
Celine Globus stood in the middle of Fortiter's bridge, holding on to one of the structural supports and somehow managing to appear unaffected by the feeling of 4G that remained after the ship's dampeners absorbed as much thrust as they could. He'd been watching the bombing runs all along the line. Some groups of fighters had as few as 3 or 4, and others were decently organized makeshift squadrons. But whatever the size or the composition, they all surged forward like the wrath of God. Not one single fighter held back or failed to attack with a vigor that left even the veteran Palatian commander with nothing but silent respect.
No words would have sufficed to praise the heroism and determination he was witnessing. And that he would follow.
We're going in. I want us close enough to these bastards to hit them with a club.
Even as he spoke, Fortiter shook again. Another hit. He shrugged it off. The fight had come down to the end, and now it would be for warriors to finish it. The battle wouldn't be won now by lasers or particle accelerators or even super-advanced railguns. It was the hearts of men and women that mattered now. At least that was how Globus saw it. He stood firm where he was, his Palatian blood boiling. His four battleships were all damaged, two of them badly, but every one still had at least some thrust capacity, and they were blasting at full now, weapons firing ceaselessly as the distance slipped with each passing second. 10,000 kilometers, unheard of for capital ships, but still he kept his force moving in. 9,000. He could see Fortiter's battery's hit ratios increasing. Even the enemy's superior thrust and AI capabilities were of limited value at so close a range. Globus was scared, though as a Palatian patrician he'd never admit it, not even to himself. But he was exhilarated, too, and he could feel the tide turning. Thanks to the work of the fighter squadrons, the victory was there for the taking. He was sure of it, and he wouldn't let up, not until the enemy turned tail and ran back where they'd come from. He looked at the display again. 7,000 kilometers. Fortiter's batteries fired again, and he could see the hits slamming into the target vessel, and great geysers erupting from the gaping wounds they created, the long streams of gases and fluids flash freezing in the frigid cold of space. 6,000 kilometers. He smiled and whispered to himself a phrase he'd spoken since childhood, and one that said everything that mattered. The way is the way.
Chapter 44. PUV Carcaju. Approaching Baru, Rian System, Union Year 219, 315 AC. Denisov sat quietly on Carcaju's bridge, watching the cataclysmic destruction he'd unleashed. He'd always considered himself a professional naval officer, not some kind of sadist or mass murderer. He'd silently detested the brutal and totalitarian aspects of the Union's government, as so many long-term professionals in the Navy did. But now he realized he'd crossed a line, one that would brand him forever, one that made him what he'd always despised. He suspected the specific definition of a mass murder varied with different factors, situation, provocation, but mostly the number of dead. The death toll on Baru would be in the millions, if not the billions, and he was pretty sure that guaranteed him a spot on anyone's list. He watched as the massive chunks of rock slipped into Baru's orbital track. A few struck fortresses, obliterating them in an instant before continuing down toward the atmosphere. And right behind the wave of destruction came Denisov's fleet. His ships closed on the distracted and damaged fortresses, destroying those the asteroids had spared. The dust and other interference affected their fire, but the station's focus on trying to stop the asteroids allowed his ships to close to stunningly close range. He leaned back in his chair, pushing away the feelings of guilt for what he had done. He'd had no choice. He told himself that again and again, and in a sense it was true. Retreating to Montmorel would have meant facing Gaston Villeneuve's wrath. The man's brutal rage could have consumed many of Denisov's officers and even their families. But for all the truth in his internal defense, he wondered if it could justify the millions who were about to die. History's greatest tyrants, its most infamous killers, all had their own justifications. He shrugged, pushing the thoughts away. There would be time for self-recrimination later. Now he had a job to do. He defeated Baru's previously impregnable orbital defenses. It was time to secure the planet. Baru's people would die by the millions as the asteroids came down from the sky, blasting the surface like some enraged deity's wrath unchained. But there would be survivors, probably many millions of them. Planetary populations were extremely difficult to exterminate entirely. And that population, whatever remained of it, had to be brought under Union control.
Lieutenant, the transports are to advance and enter orbit.
Yes, sir.
It was time. Baru had escaped the Union's grasp for nearly 3 years. But all that was over now. Those planets that had looked on, encouraged by Baru's rebellion, would learn a new lesson from that planet's agony. Denisov was ashamed of his central role in bringing that about, but he knew Gaston Villeneuve would approve wholeheartedly.
All units are to prepare for landing operations. The ground assault will commence immediately after the last impacts.
Hoover stumbled toward the door, struggling as he carried Breen's unconscious body over his shoulders. He'd been surprised when Bernard's resistance fighters had saved his life, but then he had just done the same for the rebel commander, so perhaps it had been payback of a sort. Whatever it was, he knew he had to get the hell out of the building. It looked like Bernard's decapitation strike had succeeded, but that didn't change the fact that Delacorte had already sent for help. Hundreds, if not thousands, of soldiers loyal to Caron were no doubt on the way. There was also another concern, one even deadlier than Caron's people. Union forces. The information he'd gleaned in the moments before the strike had been far from conclusive, but they were profoundly disturbing. If the Union fleet was doing what he thought they were, it was going to be hard to find a safe refuge anywhere on Beru. He was about to duck through the doorway, or more accurately, the gaping hole where the door had been moments before. He saw Caron. Several of Bernard's people had cornered the first protector of Beru, and it looked like Caron's murderous regime was about to end in a rather final way. One of the resistance fighters shoved the butt of his rifle into Caron's gut, and he doubled over and dropped to his knees, coughing up blood. Hoover knew Caron deserved what he was about to get. He couldn't even imagine the amount of blood on the man's hands, but if Bernard's people just murdered the captive Caron, they would be going down the same road as the last regime. He turned and walked back into the room. "Stop," he said, moving toward the fighters who were still beating Caron. "Stop that." "Who the hell are you?" One of the soldiers turned to face him, holding a pistol in one hand and a long notched blade in the other. The knife was covered with a bright sheen of blood. Hoover stopped, leaning down and putting Breen gently on the floor. He moved slowly in a way that made it clear he wasn't reaching for a weapon. "I'm Mike Hoover, Confederation Intelligence. Congratulations on the success of your strike, but you can't just murder that man." "Says you." The man glared at him, and Hoover could see his fingertips tightening around the knife. "This bastard had my brother killed, and his wife and children, too. He's a piece of pig shit, and it's way past time he got what's coming to him, so get lost while you still can." Hoover could hear the rage in the man's words, feel his need for vengeance. But he stayed where he was. "I'm not saying he doesn't deserve to die, but you have to do it right. You can't just beat him to death right here." "I can do whatever the hell I want, asshole, and then I can do the same to—" "Reins, stand down. You will not threaten Agent Hoover." Hoover recognized Bernard's voice. "Yes, sir." The fighter backed down immediately. His expression was sullen, but he obeyed Bernard without question. Hoover turned to face the resistance leader just as Bernard said, "I understood why you toned me down earlier, Agent Hoover, but I'm somewhat at a loss as to why you feel you must defend our good first protector here. All of these men and women have lost friends and relatives to Caron's death squads. So tell me, why should I order them to spare him?" Hoover suddenly felt uncomfortable, and he wondered how he would react if those dear to him had been slain by Caron's people. "I'd probably be cutting his heart out right now." "I didn't say you should spare him. I said you shouldn't murder him here. Bring him somewhere. Conduct some kind of trial. You spoke earlier of the Confederation as an inspiration. Well, no matter how terrible the crime in the Confederation, the accused gets a trial before punishment is inflicted." Hoover knew he was painting an optimistic image, one that was untrue far too often. He was well aware that many people were denied fair trials in the Confederation, that corruption and abuse were nearly as endemic as they were in the Union. It was the nearly that made all the difference, though. "We are not exactly in a position to conduct a trial, Agent Hoover. Until a few hours ago, we were all in hiding, being hunted night and day. I don't even know the status of things right now. I sent teams to secure crucial installations, but our communications are out. Delacorte's people are probably jamming us." Hoover thought about the scanner reports that came in just before the assault. "I know why your comm is out, and it has nothing to do with the late Amy Delacorte or her enforcers. The Union forces are back, and this time they're bombarding Beru with asteroids."
"With what?"
Bernard looked confused. "They're hurling huge rocks down at your planet. It's probably the disturbance in the atmosphere that is interfering with your communications."
"What do we care if a few space boulders are coming towards the planet? Better than nuclear warheads, at least?"
No, it's not better. You don't understand the kinetic energy a 10-kilometer asteroid can release. Each one will be like thousands of nuclear detonations, and there may be several dozen projectiles of this nature. It will be Armageddon all across the planet. You have to collect your people now and get them out of here, out of the city. If I'm right, virtually everything man-made on Beru will be destroyed, possibly within minutes. Getting to the wilderness is your only hope. Hoover knew he sounded crazy, and he was stunned when Bernard just nodded his assent. Then the resistance leader turned and shouted for his fighters to get out of the building and form up in the street. And he shocked Hoover again when he ordered his people to bring Caron with them, alive. Hoover reached down to pick up Breen, just as two of Bernard's people beat him to it. "Come with us, Agent Hoover," Bernard said. "My people will kill your associate. We will go to our refuge in the hills outside the city." Hoover just nodded, and then he followed Bernard and the two men carrying Breen out into the street. Hoover looked down from the high ridgeline toward the smoldering orange glow that had once been Beru City. The planet's capital had escaped a direct hit from one of the asteroid impacts, but that hadn't spared it from the shockwaves and thermal blasts. The city had become a raging inferno, and it had been reduced utterly to ruins, as Hoover suspected, at just about every other built-up area on the planet. Forests all around were on fire as well, the old-growth trees lighting up the dust-obscured sky, or already reduced to ashes. The Resistance hideout had proven to be a lucky spot, one well situated to offer shelter and protection. The high ridgelines offered significant cover from the blast waves that had leveled the capital. The sky was as hazy and choked by dust and smoke as it was anywhere, but all things considered, it was just about the best place to be. Hoover had been out three times already, a risky move with residual impacts still occurring and roving bands of desperate survivors wandering out from the city. But he was responsible for the entire Confederation contingent, his own people, and the crew of the last smuggler ship who'd been trapped on Beru by the Union blockade. He'd managed to find three of his own people, and four of the ship's crew, but that left more than 20 missing. Bernard had sent out a dozen patrols of his own, and save for the two that hadn't returned, they all reported the same thing that Hoover had seen. Nothing but blasted ruins as far as the eye could see. A few of the scattered bands of survivors had joined up with the resistance forces, and Bernard had ordered his people to share their dwindling rations and water supplies with the refugees. Hoover was impressed with the humanity of it all, but he wondered if, for all his blustering about Confederation ideals, he wouldn't have kept what he had for his own people. There was no way of knowing what food and supplies would be retrievable, and it wouldn't be long before the stunned groups of survivors turned feral and started killing each other for scraps of stale bread. Hoover turned and walked back into the makeshift camp, toward the small shelter Bernard had made his headquarters. He had to have a long talk with the Resistance commander. Bernard had been focused on defeating Remy Caron and his people, and now on providing whatever aid he could to the desperate survivors. But there was another problem, one Hoover knew would push Bernard's fighters to the brink. The scouting parties had reported something other than destruction and scattered refugees. Soldiers, heavily armed and armored, were moving around the formerly inhabited areas, rounding up any survivors they came into contact with. The descriptions were all the same. Black body armor, perfect unison in their marches, and long, fully automatic rifles that also launched grenades. Bernard's people didn't recognize the soldiers by sight, but Hoover did. And he knew the resistance warriors would know them too, as soon as he spoke their name. Foudre Rouge. Chapter 45. CFS Dauntless. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC. Baron walked slowly across the catwalk, looking out over the open area of Dauntless's main engineering section. The immense reactors that powered the enormous vessel were situated just below, and the engines that produced its thrust lay to the aft. It was a larger space by far than that on the previous Dauntless, and better laid out, too. His old ship had served well, and he would never forget her, but the class had been a little haphazard in its design, and decades of service and refits to bring the old girl up to modern standards had created somewhat of a chaotic rabbit warren of passageways and access tubes. The new ship was now like the old in one important way, however. Everywhere Baron looked, he could see the scars of battle. The pristine shininess of the new vessel was gone. Burned-out equipment, gashes in the bulkhead, even a blackened area where an internal fire had gotten out of control. They all served to mark the new Dauntless as a veteran of battle. Some of his people had died in that fight, and that was at the forefront of his mind.
Dallas had suffered 31 fatalities in the two battles against the hegemony forces, and for all the pain that caused, he knew the flagship had escaped lightly. 6 battleships and 14 escort ships had been destroyed outright in the battle, most with a loss of all hands, and the majority of the other ships had suffered losses far in excess of Dauntless's. Cillian Globus's Alliance ships had probably taken the worst of it. Globus had pushed his vessels hard, driving them almost to hull to hull contact, pouncing on the enemy battleships hard on the heels of Stockton's bombing runs. He'd lost one of his 4 battleships outright, and each of the other 3 had taken major damage, with no fewer than 200 dead on any of them. Baron was grateful for the heroism of his Alliance comrades, and for the courage all his people had displayed. But he knew the victory, if he could convince himself to call such a bloody nightmare a victory, was owed almost entirely to Jake Stockton and his pilots. Stockton had led his disordered and disorganized wings against the enemy battle line at the height of the deadly struggle, and he'd sent them in, wave after wave, closing beyond point-blank range and planting their plasma torpedoes right into the guts of the hegemony ships. The squadrons had been nothing short of heroic, including one pilot, a Lieutenant Eve Grenner, who had taken her damaged ship and blasted it right for one of the enemy battleships, activating the plasma torpedo stuck in her bomb bay and slamming it into the hegemony vessel as a sphere of pure energy. Baron had used his semi-viceregal powers as head of the White Fleet to posthumously award her the Confederation Star, all the while thinking how meaningless such gestures really were in the wake of a fine comrade's death. The hegemony fleet had finally had enough, and its battered remains turned and fled. And then Baron had done something that still gnawed at him. He'd immediately ordered his ships to pursue, to maintain contact by any means possible, and to make sure not a single enemy ship escaped, whatever the cost. He suspected the order, and the intensity with which it had been given, had increased Globus's already lofty respect for him. But there was more than honor and vengeance in his reasoning. Vengeance meant almost nothing to him, not now. Not when he was facing the reality that he'd found a deadly new enemy, a grave threat to the Confederation, and to all the other Rim nations. It was that reality, and his realization of how difficult it would be to fight the war that was likely coming, that had spurred him to mercilessly hunt down and destroy the enemy survivors. His ships had been at a disadvantage in thrust, weapon power, AI sophistication, almost everything that affected the outcome of a battle. Save for the fighters. Baron had no idea of the enemy's communications potential, no way of knowing what information had already been transmitted up the line. But he did know that he needed to maintain the mystery of the fighter squadrons in any way possible to prevent new enemy forces from studying what had happened and developing tactics to counter the wings. It was the only choice that made sense. It was also a choice that had cost him hundreds more of his own people and 3 more of his ships. But as far as the fleet scanners could determine, the pursuit, which stretched to the transit point and into the Z-12 system, had been a success. Not a single hegemony ship had escaped.
"We've got crews working around the clock, Admiral. We've got thrust up to 70%. I'll deny I said it if you tell anyone else, but in a pinch, I think I can get you 80. The primaries are still out, but we should have them up and running by tomorrow. 3 of the secondary turrets are still out. I think we'll have 2 of them online by around the time the primaries are back. The third's pretty much done, at least this side of space dock."
Fritz had come walking down the catwalk from the other direction. "Well done, Fritzy, as always." Baron's tone was a bit distracted. He'd seen the remains of the crew from that last turret. They had been nearly obliterated. "I appreciate you diving in on Dauntless's repairs, but I need you to keep the damage control crews on the other ships working at something like your normal amazing pace, too."
"I'm on it, sir. We should have every ship in the fleet at least reasonably operational within 36 hours.
"That's good, Fritzy. Do anything you can to keep us to that schedule. Or even shorten it. I'd like to get out of here before any new enemy forces show up."
"I'll see to it, sir. I'll even try to get that 36 down below 30.
"Watch out, Fritzy. You know once you put something like that in my head, I'm gonna hold you to it." She just smiled. He'd have bet his last credit on her beating 30 hours.
"Is that a power surge at the transit point?"
Buck Horace was pacing across Kraken's bridge. His ship was back in Z-12 on patrol again to warn the fleet if more enemy forces arrived. It had been quiet, not so much as an errant meteor slipping through any of the system's transit points. Horace knew the withdrawal orders could come at any time.
The landing parties had been retrieved, and the post-battle repairs were almost complete enough to allow the fleet to head back home, bringing the news of another enemy, and possibly another war, back to Megara. But he was determined not to let his guard drop, not for an instant, not until his ship was back in Z-11.
"It appears to be normal fluctuation, sir, strong but within typical parameters."
Horace's response was something between muttering and a grunt. He was considered a grouchy old cuss, to put it lightly, and he'd run his spacers on Kraken harder than he had his cadets at the academy. His people on Kraken were no doubt tired, but most of them had quickly become devoted to the captain who'd shown them just how good they could be. They could complain about him, quietly grumble when he wasn't around, but God help some loudmouth from another ship who had anything negative to say about the old man.
"I want the scanners focused on that point, Lieutenant, and I want a short spread of drones launched."
He knew they all probably thought he was being paranoid, and maybe he was, but Kraken was about to leave the system and the fleet was preparing for the voyage back home. In his experience, that was the time when things went to crap.
"Yes, Captain."
A moment later. "Drones ready to launch."
"Launch. Lock onto them as soon as they're clear and feed the data to my station."
He walked back across the bridge, dropping hard into his chair.
"Yes, sir."
Horace reached out and punched at the controls below his small screen. Baron would send word soon, he was sure of it, the orders for Kraken to return and rejoin the fleet for the journey home. But until then, he was going to watch that transit point like a hawk. Baron stood outside the entrance to sickbay, struggling to make himself step through the doorway. He'd been to see Otara every day since the landing parties had been certified free of the disease and shuttled back up to the fleet. But every minute he'd spent at her side had been a torment. Otara Travis had been one of the strongest, most alive people he'd ever known, and it was difficult beyond words to watch her lying in a coma, motionless inside her frigid med pod. He knew he should be grateful she was alive, if alive was even how he'd characterize her condition. Doc Weldon had all but assured him his friend would be dead by now, but she'd clung stubbornly to life, shocking Dauntless's entire medical team. Weldon finally changed his prediction, though he was very clear he didn't expect her to improve much either. "It's a possibility." That was what Weldon had told Baron when the Admiral had asked about her chances of recovering, but his words were heavily shadowed by doubt. He was about to step through the hatch when a large man came out, walking slowly and supporting himself with a cane.
"Admiral,"
he said, struggling to quickly straighten his posture. "At ease, Brian, please. The last thing I want is to see you tumbling over trying to salute or something." Rogan had always been very formal in Baron's presence, and even now, barely able to stand, he was the same old Marine he'd been years before, when a new captain showed up to take command of a ship called Dauntless.
"Yes, sir."
Rogan's voice was stronger than it had been 2 days earlier, when Baron had last talked to him. The Marine still looked a bit shaky, but Doc Weldon had assured him Rogan was completely recovered from the disease. His lingering weakness had more to do with his extended stretch in cryostasis than with a pathogen that had come so close to killing him.
"Are you here to see Captain Travis, Admiral?"
Baron nodded. "Yes. I'm not sure if it helps anything, but I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't get down here at least once a day."
"It helps, sir. I'm sure it does.
Thank you, Brian." His first thought was that Rogan was trying to humor him, to make him feel a little bit better. But Brian Rogan was the most honest person Baron had ever known, and realizing that made him feel a little better.
"I think you should go get some rest, Brian. I need you back as soon as possible."
"I'm ready, sir, for whatever you need."
Baron looked at the Marine, barely able to hold himself up with a cane, and then he realized Rogan was dead serious.
"I know that, Brian."
Baron managed to smile. "Now go get some rest."
He stood where he was for a few more seconds, and then he slipped into sickbay. Weldon was standing in the main room, issuing orders to a group of med techs. He turned as soon as he realized Baron was there.
"Any changes, Doc?"
Baron already knew the answer from Weldon's expression.
"Nothing, sir, but no worsening either, which, considering the circumstances, is its own bit of good news."
Baron wasn't sure he bought the doctor's positive spin, but he nodded, and then he walked across the room and slipped into the small alcove that held Travis in her med pod. She looked the same as she had every time he'd come. Still. Lifeless. She was alive, he knew that much at least. But each time he came and saw her in the same state, he lost a little more hope.
"Otara, I'm so sorry I let you go down there in my place."
He knew there was no logic to the statement. In all likelihood, he lacked her natural immunity, and that meant he would have died with all the others. In a sense, it had been a stroke of fortune that she had been part of the landing party, that her natural resistance to the disease was able to save hundreds of her comrades. Just, please, not at the cost of her own life. He moved next to the pod, reaching out and putting his hand on the cold glass. There was nothing he could do, nothing he could say. All he could do was be there, even though he knew she couldn't tell. Her brain function was still active, but she was deep in a coma. He sat for a while, 10 minutes, 20. He lost a sense of it. Then Weldon came in. "Admiral, it's the control center. They need to speak with you." Weldon's voice was deadly serious. "Now." Baron leapt up and jogged out into the main room, leaning over the comm. "Baron here."
"Admiral."
It was Sony Eaton's voice, and there was definitely something wrong. "Captain Horace just transited back from Z-12, sir. Kraken picked up enemy forces entering from the system's Alpha transit point. He reports..." She paused, and Baron's blood went cold. "He reports it appears to be a larger force than the previous one." Baron heard the words, but he grappled with their true meaning. "Larger than the previous one?" Another silence, and then almost an answer to his thought.
"Substantially larger, sir."
Chapter 46. CFS Dauntless, Z-11 System, Year 315 AC. "The enemy forces are crossing the Z-12 system at a high velocity. We can wrap up necessary repairs and head for the transit point leading toward home, but it's likely enemy forces will enter this system before we're able to get every ship out, and even if we can, it will be by the slimmest of margins. Our best efforts at masking our drive trails will be insufficient to prevent the enemy from scanning the direction in which we headed." Sarah Eaton stood in Dauntless's conference room, looking as tense as she sounded. Baron had called his officers back for another face-to-face meeting. He justified it because Fritz and her people needed a few more hours anyway to get the final repairs completed, but there was more to it than that. They weren't all going to make it out of Z-11, and he felt that the parting he saw coming was best done face-to-face. "It will be like giving them a roadmap back to the Rim, at least if they're smart and aggressive enough to pursue immediately. They're faster than we are, and they'll be able to stay with the fleet, note each transit point we use. If we can't lose them here, we won't get another chance. We'll get back to warn the Admiralty, and the threat will be hours behind us." Sonya Eden added her thoughts to her older sister's report, and again Baron was struck by how similar they were to each other. They didn't so much look the same, but their demeanors, their coolness under fire, it was like watching the same officer in two different places. "That's something we can't do." Baron's voice was deep, raw. He leaned forward and put his hands on the table, pushing himself to his feet as he spoke. "We must get a warning home. This is of the utmost urgency, and that warning must arrive before any enemy can follow. Hopefully significantly before." He was silent for a moment, thinking, though he knew he'd made his decision. He was grim, and he could feel it bearing down on him. "Commodore Eaton, you'll take a command of a small force, all ships with full thrust capacity or close to it, and you will return to Megara immediately to warn the Admiralty and the Senate." He looked over at Globus. "Cillian, you must go too. This is a threat to all of us, and you need to get to Palatia and report to Imperator Tullus as quickly as possible. I know he'll listen to you." Globus looked as though he was going to argue, but he remained silent. "I'll take the rest of the fleet and transit into Z-12 to intercept the Hegemony fleet there. We will conduct a running fight, relying heavily on fighter attacks, and then after we've bought enough time for the returning force to get out of the system, we will pull back. We'll fly through another transit point, hopefully baiting the enemy to follow us, and conclude that our home systems lie in that direction." The room was silent. Baron's plan would mean a few of their number would return home, while most of the rest of the fleet, and its spacers, would buy the time to make good that escape, very likely at the cost of their lives. Cillian Globus shifted in his seat. "Admiral, my forces will stay. We will not run, certainly not while our comrades and allies remain to fight." Baron sighed softly. He'd been expecting the argument, and he was ready for it. As ready as he could be. "Cillian, no one is happy with the situation, but there's more than courage or honor at stake here. The Hegemony is a threat to the Confederation and to the Alliance. We've all seen their technology. We're outmatched at every turn. We must get a warning back. A Hegemony invasion is likely to be cataclysmic in any case,
If our forces are not ready, we have no chance.
Sir. The Palatian looked partially convinced, but he was still arguing. I agree that we must send a warning, but it does not. You've served alongside Vi and Tullish your entire life, Cillian. You are his brothers. He must receive the warning from a source he trusts without question. He must hear this from you.
There was a short silence. Then Baron added, Duty first, Cillian. Would you see Palatia attacked and destroyed and your people enslaved to stay here and fight? Is that honor? It is the way?
Baron almost felt guilty. Defending their homeworld was nearly a religion in the Alliance.